Hello and welcome to Contain This. My name is Stephanie Williams and I'm Australia's Ambassador for Regional Health Security. On today's episode, we are joined by two of Fiji's health leaders who have been at the forefront of its COVID response and now at the forefront of efforts to continue to strengthen the health system for everyone. We speak first to Dr. James Fong, the Permanent Secretary for the Fijian Ministry of Health and Medical Services. I asked Dr. Fong how Fiji managed its successful vaccination rollout for COVID and what lessons he learned in the process. We then speak to Dr. Alicia Sahukan, the Head of Health Protection for the Fijian Ministry of Health and Medical Services. Dr. Sahukan reflects on the challenges of adjusting the COVID response strategy in real time and how she grew as a leader over the period. Dr. Fong's and Dr. Sahukan's own reflections in this episode demonstrate qualities of health leadership in the COVID pandemic period. On World Health Day this year, the theme is Our People and Our Planet, and we should be thinking about the type of health leadership required to take the urgent actions in all sectors needed to address the health impacts of climate change. This is an important conversation for now and the future. Dr. Fong, we have listeners on this podcast who are in Australia and all over the world, and many are familiar with the Indo-Pacific, but some are not. I wonder if you could describe some of the lessons learnt during Fiji's very successful vaccine rollout for COVID over the last year and a bit.
Yeah, I guess I need to start the answer by just stating that we had a challenge in that whilst we've had a long-standing vaccination program that would function well and deploy immunization needs, our experience with escalated deployment of vaccine was, whilst it was present, it was a bit more limited, and our capability to rapidly escalate vaccination needs was more limited. We did have prior experience with the measles meningitis C program that allowed us to develop some capability to scale up. So that was the big problem. The one problem was the ability to scale up. The second one was the fact that this program required that we had to be connected together with a digital platform that allowed us to digitally register all the vaccinations. That was a significant problem. As with many of the Pacific Island countries, we were used to just doing it on deploying and writing it in exercise books. And then later on, we come back and then we consolidate all the data together and prepare a report. In this case, we were consolidating as we were deploying. So that was a huge challenge. I think one of the biggest things that we did learn, though, was because we had begun to repurpose the health system to have a more flexible command and control structure, we were able to ensure that, you know, the vision and the purpose of all the exercise was effectively narrated and tracked. So what we did was that we had developed command centers, three command centers for the three divisional teams, and each command center had a number of subdivisional operation centers, and they all had IT support. So they had screens, Zoom link, and also a lot of these various command centers and operation centers had put together Viber groups, Viber chat groups. So, and in those Viber chat groups, many of us, Dr. Alicia, myself, and Dr. Chemesa, were all in the Viber group. So we could see in real time what everybody was doing and how they were progressing with regards to their percentage coverages. And we could, you know, provide ongoing encouragement, ongoing feedback also on some of their activities. The other thing that we, you know, that we had to work very quickly with, and we had to develop extra capability in, was in relation to community engagement, looking at new ways of new strategies for community engagement, and of course the risk communication that was involved in that exercise. So by having those structures that I mentioned, the command centers and the operation centers, ensuring that the digital space was stable enough for us to provide a measure of command and control over the operation, then allowing us all to have a shared vision of where we wanted to go, it allowed us also to share lessons learned and what we needed to do, especially with regards to community engagement. I think community engagement was the hard part, but we couldn't even get all those lessons out. We could not even look at strategies unless we had a stable digital space to work with.
Can I ask some more questions about this command and control structure? These were set up purely for the vaccine rollout. Are they continuing in any form, or were they a short-term structural change?
Oh, no, no. What happened was that in the first wave, after the first wave came to Fiji, we, once the first wave settled down, we reorganized the health system so that we could have this command and control structure that will allow us to do anything. The whole purpose was to be able to scale up and scale down. So what happened was that if there was one issue that would, if for example, if it's an epidemic, the command and control structure will reflect only on the epidemic. But as soon as the epidemic is over, we would change the agenda and get them to start dealing with other surge issues that relate to NCDs, leptospirosis, dengue. So there is an ongoing capability within each of the structures or command and control structures to be able to adequately manage challenges as they came along. One of the key aspects of the command and control structures is for each of the operation centers to have what we call line lists. And basically, we started off with line lists of vulnerable persons. So what you did was that you went right down to the most peripheral area in the medical, what we call the medical area. Each medical area then would have a line list of all the vulnerable persons that stayed within that area. And I mean, okay, even more peripheral is the zone nurses. The zone nurses would have a list of all the diabetics that they had, the names, the address, and everything. And then that was fed back up the chain so that each operation centers in each of the subdivisions do have a line list of vulnerable persons, their contact numbers, what medications they are on. And all they do is they provide oversight over the management to ensure that they are appearing for the clinics that they appear for, and that their medication, if they're not appearing, that their medication supply is given. The idea was that to try and get the vulnerable as stable as possible. And that was one key area. So it meant that for vaccination, it meant that we outlined all the vulnerable groups, and then in each medical area, they had to look for those people personally and talk them into seeing if they can get them vaccinated. There were a few of them that actually refused vaccination. That's okay, but at least we could tick off that they were counseled and offered the vaccination option.
So how are you using that in terms of improving booster coverage in Fiji, which I know is a challenge?
So because we've got the majority of them on a line list, that makes it easier for us to concentrate on the vulnerables and the willing, those who are willing to be vaccinated plus the vulnerable. So that makes it a bit easier. But having said that, as I mentioned, one of the other parts of our success was the fact that we could scale up. And unfortunately for a country like Fiji, scaling up meant that you had to have a whole of government approach. One of the reasons why we are struggling at the moment with our booster doses is because now we don't have the whole of government. We don't have access to all the transports. We don't have access to all the various other logistics support that we had before. And so, despite that, we have been able, in some of the vulnerable groups, we've been able to achieve 25, 30, 40% coverage in some of the subgroups. I know that overall we are up to about 20% of the of those who've had a second dose have had a booster. So that in itself is we've got some traction there. I should also mention one more small thing is that we were a little bit hampered in our deployment of the booster doses. Because after 2 years of working, everybody needed to go and leave. a lot of our medical staff were beginning to feel the difficulty of, you know, sustaining the energy. So they had to go and leave. And also now we have to do catch up of our immunization programs that are not related to COVID-19. So the same group of people will also have to do other vaccination programs. And because school has started, we now have to make sure that all our school children are adequately covered in terms of vaccination. So those are some of the key issues that have slowed us down a bit. But it's only slowing down our reaching out capability. But, you know, we're narrating the fact that the vaccines are available in the facilities for people to come to.
So, Dr. Fong, you mentioned NCDs and leptospirosis and the routine immunisation as a series of other health challenges that don't go away even when COVID is here. And you also mentioned some of the workforce challenges. How are you thinking about what some of the health system priorities are for Fiji in terms of the health workforce in particular over the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think a lot of the other directions are directions that we are currently working on. Reaching out into the private sector, having greater engagement with the private sector to be able to support us in some of our endeavors, especially in trying to reach into the community using the private sector. I believe that we will have to build a lot more relationships with our CSOs. And one of the key areas of function really is working with the network that supports disabled persons. That network has what we call community rehabilitation workers. They have village health workers. And they also have a wider variety of CSO-related relationships that allow them to get and penetrate the community a lot better. I think that at the end of the day, if we can use all the various networks in the private sector plus the non-government organizations to bolster the message for prevention, but also more importantly, to be able to refine our secondary prevention program through the line list management program. Because the line list does allow us to target our energies to areas of need. I think my biggest problem with primary prevention is that we spread ourselves too thin and we are not able to focus on the people that really need us. Whereas with secondary prevention, we are able to get to the people who really need our message and need our service. And we're able to achieve the idea of reaching the right people at the right time.
Can I ask you a last question, which is self-reflective? I'm interested in what you have learned about yourself as a health leader over the last 2+ years.
I must admit, there are some parts of leadership that I didn't envision that I had the ability to sort through. A lot of it dealt with working in areas outside of health, working with tourism, working with the private sector, the trade sector. But I think one of the lessons that I basically learned was that, you know, there were so many lessons that you learn through life that you can actually apply in other areas. And it's amazing how there are shared strategies that cut across many, many different areas of living that, you know, that you don't envision because you're so tied down in one area. But I've been an obstetrician gynecologist for most of my life. But in the course of doing obstetrics and gynecology, in order for us to have a functional system, I had to step out of the speciality and engage with procurements, pharmacies, stores, engage with the Ministry of Economy over many, many years in order for us to keep our system tight and functional. And now I've realized that, you know, it's served me quite well in terms of becoming a permanent secretary, recognizing areas that require my urgent attention and being able to find, not so much find the solution, but being able to put in place a structure that can find the solution for us. And that has become something that I think that's probably one of the biggest lessons that that I've learned, is that I don't have to solve the problems all the time. As long as I know how to set up a structure that can find solutions and give us good options, I think that's most of the better done. And I think I'm hoping that one of the things that I didn't like about COVID is that it put very few people to the forefront. Like, it made me and Alisa and Dr. Chemesa stand right up in front. I'm hoping that, but I've learned very strongly that, you know, sometimes, many times, the measure of our success will be when we can step back and all the other directors and all the other line managers will start to get the limelight and they begin to put up successful programs. That, to me, is going to be the final measure of, you know, whatever legacy that we leave behind.
Thank you for those reflections. Dr. Sahu Khan, Dr. Fong just talked about being in the spotlight and having the relentless attention during COVID, which is something I know you faced in your role as the head of health protection. I wonder if you could reflect on what some of your biggest achievements, your collective achievements, have been focused on laboratory testing, in particular in Fiji, over the last 2 years.
So throughout the pandemic, it was very important for the public to have spokespeople from the Ministry of Health and Medical Services, particularly because the Ministry of Health agency did take the lead role, particularly during the worst parts of the pandemic. And within the Ministry of Health, it was our permanent secretary, Dr. Fong, and our chief medical advisor, Dr. Chemesa Tundravu, as well as myself, who were the faces of the response. I think all of us would tell you that that role was not something any of us envisaged for ourselves when we became doctors. And I think that's something that we learned was very important. And I guess we took on that role really, really to try and try and show what the Ministry of Health was doing, as well as advise the public about the progress of the pandemic, etc. In terms of lessons learned from the pandemic, and specifically looking at laboratory testing. So during the pandemic, laboratory testing really had to be upscaled at a very rapid pace. We have PCR testing in Fiji. Our PCR lab actually opened in March of 2020. We were able, of course, you will know, to keep the virus out of Fiji for a year, up until April of 2021. Once the Delta wave hit us in April of 2021, we had to really vastly upgrade our testing. So we expanded the testing to 6 labs within the Ministry of Health and Medical Services. And that included, of course, all the testing personnel that were required, testing consumables that were required. And we ended up doing a massive amount of testing. At the peak of the outbreak, we were testing at about 4.5 per 1,000 population, which is about 20 to 28,000 samples a week. And this is just out of 6 labs in Fiji. And there was a comparable level of testing to our neighbors, much more developed neighbors in the Pacific, such as Australia and New Zealand. What we did learn, however, with the testing, we did know we were aiming to test as much as possible with the intent to try and contain the outbreak. So anybody who was getting symptoms needed to get tested, needed to be isolated. However, there was a point where it became very clear that the outbreak was so widespread, that so many people had COVID-19, that we had to narrow down and prioritize our testing, because there's no point in testing indiscriminately when you're not following up with public health action or even clinical action. So testing, diagnostics needs to be connected to action. So what we did at that peak of the outbreak, we announced that we would be limiting our testing now to persons who are at most risk of developing severe disease, and including testing before admission to hospital so that people could be isolated in the isolation wards in the hospital. So I think that's a lesson learned in a developing country where you do have limited resources, may not be the best way forward in responding to outbreaks such as this. Of course, now our testing is much more open, and it is very much used as a predictor, an early warning for surges of COVID-19.
Dr. Serhakhan, when you look back at that strategy change that you described about testing to enable containment versus conserving resources for testing for the most high-risk patients, when you look back at that, can you remember how long that change took to agree and to implement?
I will say it was difficult because all of us in the Ministry of Health, we were all in the mindset of trying to contain the outbreak. And that was just how we operated. So right in the beginning of the Delta wave, for example, anybody who tested positive for COVID-19 was admitted to hospital, regardless of whether they were symptomatic or asymptomatic or what their risk status was in terms of severe disease. They were admitted to an isolation ward in the hospital. As we got more and more cases, it became clear that it just did not make sense to put people who have mild disease or have no symptoms into a hospital setting. So then we expanded and started having what you call community isolation centers. So this may be schools, this may be hotels that were used as isolation centers. So anyone who tested positive, regardless of whether they had symptoms or not, were put into these community isolation centers. Eventually, of course, what happened, as we got more and more cases, all of these centers became full. And then the decision had to be made that now we will tell the public, if you test positive for COVID-19, please self-isolate, isolate at home. So really the progress of the outbreak itself forced us to make these decisions as we went on, because it just became not possible to maintain the same strategies as the outbreak progressed. So a similar thing happened with COVID-19 testing, but I will say that it did happen a bit slower. We were still trying to test as many people as possible, give them their results, let them know that they need to isolate. However, of course, what happened here and what happens in most countries that go through these big waves is that things like test turnaround time suffered. So we had someone that could get sampled, and then they may wait 5, 6, or 7 days before they got a result. So we did have to really engage the public to do their own risk assessment, because essentially that was we had to make do with the resources that we had at the time, and we had to prioritize the resources towards making the most difference. And at that point, it wasn't about stopping transmission as we were trying to do. It was about mitigating the risk of severe disease, so trying to reduce hospitalizations, trying to reduce deaths. And at the same time, of course, our vaccination program was running along this response. So really, a lot of the containment efforts initially was trying to buy time to get more and more people vaccinated. But then it came to a point where we also had to change our response in tandem with what we were seeing with the outbreak itself, to make the most difference and to mitigate the risk of severe disease.
I'm interested, from a surveillance and testing perspective, what is still on your to-do list in terms of future improvements that you think are important for detection and response in Fiji?
Well, we were fortunate that in the middle of the Delta outbreak, we were able to also deploy rapid antigen test kits. So, of course, those kits are much less labor intensive, and they're much faster turnaround time. Another issue that did come up very quickly with our laboratory testing is the support for a results reporting outlook. So as you get more and more and more samples and tests, and you need to report these tests, you need a system in place that is able to do this rapidly and with as much minimal input from our people who are already doing the testing, already doing the swabbing. So we saw that we needed a digital solution to reporting of test results. And so, of course, we took on the Tamanu web-based system, where we could actually collect the data from a patient when you're taking the swab, and then feed a test result in once a lab has done the test, or once the testing provider has provided the rapid antigen test result. And of course, then the person who's getting tested could access their result through a website. So that was a completely new system and a new way of reporting test results in Fiji that we had to put in place as we were in the middle of an outbreak. And that is a system which we are still using to today.
And how about thinking on genomic sequencing capability? It's a much talked about capacity. It's a challenging one to incorporate, mostly for the public health information requirements that come with genetic sequence data. How are you thinking about that capability in Fiji?
So currently in Fiji, we're very fortunate that the Peter Doherty Institute in Melbourne has been our reference center for COVID-19, for SARS-CoV-2 and genomic sequencing in particular. We don't yet have the capacity in country to conduct a whole genome sequencing. However, we are in the process of having that capacity, specifically at PGCDC. So we are working with the Doherty Institute as well as the WHO to set up a lab at PGCDC, and we hope to have that in place within the next 6 months. Of course, it is a very, it's not quite well understood that it's a very complicated technology. It's not the same as introducing a new testing modality like PCR, for example, because it has a laboratory component, it's got a bioinformatics component, it's got a genomic epidemiology component. And for all of that, yes, you need equipment, yes, you need consumables for the laboratory, but you also need people who are trained in each of those three components. And that is, we don't have that capacity yet in Fiji. What we are doing right now is we're working with the Doherty Institute to build that capacity, but it's a very exciting development. We're all very excited about it because we would be one of the only centers in the Pacific to have this capacity in country. And I'm hoping that in the future, we could also extend this capacity to also include other Pacific Island countries and become a regional center for genomic sequencing.
As we reflect on leadership over the last 2.5 years, I'm interested in what you yourself have learned about being a health leader, some reflections from your own experience.
Thank you. It's sometimes when I'm asked about, I'm asked questions like that, it's a little bit jarring because over the last 2 years, we in the Ministry of Health really have been operating in, emergency mode, planning and responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. And now things in terms of COVID-19 have slowed a bit, and we are all moving more towards our normative functions. So plans and projects that we had put on the back burner since COVID started, we're going back to that. And now, of course, it is also a time for self-reflection. So in terms of leadership, I think what I really learned is leadership is much easier. It's much easier to lead when you have the right people in place, when you have a good team. It really takes a lot of the work out of leadership. If you're able to have a very good team that you're able to lead, as well as processes that maybe exist from before, or that you put in place when a crisis happens like the pandemic. So that's something that I really learned. The other lesson, of course, has been that dealing with persons and organizations outside of health. So by profession, I'm a medical doctor. I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist. My focus prior to COVID has really been health-centric. And I'm very much used to basing my advice and my outlook very much just looking at the health side of a situation. What we learned through the pandemic, of course, is that health is determined by factors outside of health. There are socioeconomic factors that determine health status and public health, the health of the population. So, for example, in our response to the Delta outbreak, one of the really restrictive public health and social measures that we put in place was lockdowns. So, of course, we knew that lockdowns can be very effective when applied at the right time. And it also depends on the quality of the lockdown, on what the compliance of the community, enforcement, et cetera. However, in a developing country, in contrast to a developed country, when you put in place a lockdown, you really do need to have the social measures in place to protect the people in your society who are not able to do things like stockpile food. So that is something we did learn quite quickly, and it was definitely a lesson, because it taught a lot of us to really look outside of just the health problem. So the health problem being COVID-19, and understand that there's more at play than just one disease. You also have to look at the society and the acceptance of public health and social measures by that society, and that's critical. So I've learned a lot during these 2 years, and hopefully we will use all the lessons learned for whatever public health event that is coming our way, including our longstanding issues in public health.
And I'm sure we have more lessons to learn along the way. But thank you so much for those reflections, Dr. Sahil Khan. It's always terrific to talk with you and hear of your leadership with your team, as you have mentioned, in Fiji. Thank you so much for making the time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Contain This to mark World Health Day on the 7th of April. I'm Stephanie Williams, Australia's Ambassador for Regional Health Security. You've been listening to my conversation with Dr. James Fong, Permanent Secretary for the Fijian Ministry of Health and Medical Services, and Dr. Alicia Sahil Khan, the Head of Health Protection for the Fijian Ministry of Health and Medical Services. As at the 27th of March this year, almost 70% of Fiji's population has had two doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. This is amongst some of the highest rates in our region. Reaching this goal took a coordinated effort across medical and societal interventions. As our guests noted, leadership requires understanding factors outside of health and health systems, a lesson for us all as we face the ongoing challenges in our region, not only around an uncertain COVID-19 future, but also some of the pressing climate change and health challenges that are facing health ministries. We hope you have enjoyed this conversation. Contain This is produced by the Indo-Pacific Centre for Health Security. For more on World Health Day this year, do follow us on Twitter and Facebook.